Well, Lionel, we're not going to see much of the sprint finish, are we? But what we have seen or heard is some fairly vociferous protests here from the pro-Palestine, anti-Israel group. They've been here every day, I think.
Yeah, well, we've certainly seen them the last couple of days holding Palestinian flag, pro-Palestinian slogans and anti-Israel slogans.
And a heavy police presence as well around us.
Indeed, yeah. And I think the police are, you know, they're keeping it sensible. They're not being heavy-handed at all. They're just making sure that the banners and flags don't kind of blow in the road and cause some kind of problem for the riders.
But talking of riders, should we go and speak to some? Presumably the stage is finished.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Giro d'Italia in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee stops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport. Today we are in Nervesa della Battaglia.
Cozze, citere, cozze, cozze, vicine, non spigudeci ora, non spigudeci ora. Cozze, citere, cozze, cozze, vicine, non spigudeci ora, se non mangiano le femmine.
I'm Lionel Boney and I'm with Daniel Free.
Hello, Lionel.
We are outside the press room in Nervesa della Battaglia.
Formerly Nervesa. Became Nervesa della Battaglia, Nervesa of the Battle, after the First World War. First mistake of the evening.
1918, there was a big battle here, wasn't there?
A very important area in the First World War strategically.
We're sitting outside the press room on the grass. It's not really warm enough for this, is it? It's not been... it's a bit chilly. And I thought we were going to get another deluge.
You are in
deluge.
Your string vest, Lionel. you need to take
Naughty
the handkerchief
hanky
off your head.
Sandals and socks, eh? Paint such a flattering image, Daniel. Well, earlier we saw the race whiz by. We were at about 600 metres to go. That point on the course was notable because there was a pro-Palestine and, it has to be said, anti-Israeli demonstration. They were holding Palestinian flags and they'd been handing out leaflets, waving banners, and it just shows that, you know, nearly 2 weeks into the race, the fact that the grand start was in Israel has not been forgotten by people who opposed it at the time, and really, why would they forget that? But the stage itself was 180 kilometers. It came up here. It was a largely flat course from Ferrara. It went over the hill at Montello, which as Daniel said last night was featured in the 1985
Commission,
World Championships. How many roads
to,
up?
Yes, and I'm glad you asked me that. Cool, blimey. The Montello, as I said yesterday, it's the gym. It's the private gym of bike riders in this area. And you know how many ways up there are? 21 ways up the Montello. You could have a stage race just on the Montello, couldn't you?
You could. Of
those 21 roads up, 19 are fully tarmacked and there are two that are sterratolo, so white roads.
That's a very helpful siren in the background. Is this the pronunciation police come to get me at last?
No. and just while the siren is still wailing, the climbs on the Montello, for anyone who wants to come to this region and ride their bike, the climbs are generally between about 2 and 4 kilometres long. Some of them very, very difficult, very punchy, and a bit of a shame that the Giro didn't go up a harder way today.
I'm temporarily deaf, I think. Well, I think the peloton was craving a quiet day today. Yesterday was a lot trickier than anyone would have anticipated, made even more so by the rain. Today, I think everyone just wanted an easy-ish day. I mean, it won't have been easy. It was still rapid, but with the Zonkerland coming tomorrow, the bunch got the much-anticipated sprint finish and the much anticipated win. Elia Viviani bounced back after a bit of a shocker yesterday, but looked very good in the finish.
Lionel
today.
He wasn't too enamoured with what Ciro's colleagues wrote in La Gazzetta yesterday, so he went on Rai Television after the stage today and he made some kind of barbed reference about what they'd written. I don't know what I think they talked about the fact that, well, as we saw, Viviani had a bit of a strop.
He didn't take losing yesterday particularly well at all. Anyway, the race, there was a five-man break. Mikel Irizar of Trek, Eugène Zuppa of Villa, and Andrea Vendrami of Androni, keeping up the 100% record for Gianni Savio's team.
What's the slogan,
breaks.
Lionel? What's the slogan? Can you remember?
I can't remember. I already can't.
Cattivi e determinati.
Determination
nasty,
and enthusiasm, wasn't it?
No. Nasty, but in a sports way, as Gianni said, and determined.
Right. Alessandro Tonelli of Bardiani was in there as well, as was Marco Marcato of UAE. And they were away, well, all day until, well, most of the day. They still had just about a minute with 30 kilometres to go, and it was down to 30 seconds with 20 kilometres to go, so there's no way they were going to stay away. On the run-in, Marco Colledan of Villa Tristina.
And Treviso. Treviso area, certainly.
Okay, yeah. He's a sort of semi-local boy. He attacked, but wasn't going to hold off the sprint. It was an interesting sprint, really, because Viviani, you know, if he was looking to prove a point, he certainly proved that point emphatically, because it was an easy win for him. Sasha Modolo of EF Education First, he led at... Well, he was looking pretty good, and then...
Lionel has been causing trouble.
I've left some things in the... All I've done is left some things in the press room, and they've been brought delivered out for me. Thank you very much.
Ah, ho capito. Grazie, Steph.
This is a bottle of sparkling wine. Are they worried somebody will walk off with it?
I don't know. We've already had our run-ins with the law this... we've already been present at crime scenes this week.
Sasha Modolo was probably went too early.
Another local rider
didn't look like it wasn't convincing enough. Anyway, Viviani came from deep and won convincingly, and then Sam Bennett sort of came up on the other side and didn't have enough and wasn't going to close the gap, but did get second place. Viviani had also pinched 3 points at the intermediate sprint, so if his Ciclamino jersey was looking in any doubt yesterday, it's very firmly on his shoulders again today. Yesterday's 18 point lead is now 40 points. The other notable thing that happened today was that Esteban Chavez of Mitchelton Scott, who had been second overall not that long ago, he was last man over the line, quarter of an hour down, and almost 5 minutes behind the rider just in front of him.
We saw a lot of riders coming in. Well, as you'll be able to see if you look at the results, there were a lot of fairly decent climbers as well who came in pretty late today. Tony Martin was one of the last guys on the road, just moseying in. He's had a pretty anonymous Giro d'Italia, particularly when, you know, we've talked about these punchy finishes, and there would have been some latitude for a finisher to make some headway in this Giro d'Italia, and Tony Martin is very good at going away in the closing stages. We've just been joined by
Good evening, Ciro.
Thanks. Ciao, dear listeners. It has been a kind of self-invitation this time, tonight, because I need this. You know, we are seeing a weekend with a lot of mountains. Mountains, for me, means nightmare. And
Ciro,
so
Ciro,
I need you.
Ciro, before we start lurching into that territory... Tell us about Viviani and La Gazzetta. He wasn't too happy with your boys.
No, not really, because, I mean, on the article of today, I mean, we criticized...
Written by who?
By me personally, dear listener, because sometimes I write articles. It's strange to... But it's
usually
like,
you love interviewing Viviani. You call him Radio Viviani, usually.
Yeah. And I must confess that during the Dubai tour, I was also the privilege to have an interview in his own room in the hotel, a kind of privilege, I guess. Yes, but in the articles today, we criticize him a little bit for his bad performance of yesterday. You know, he arrived yesterday at 9 minutes, so he was not really happy for this, and he talked about me in the Processo alla tappa, the right transmission after the stage, but I have the possibility to clarify my position with him, and I told me, Elia, maybe with this fact that you spoke about me in TV, maybe you wanted to give me a little bit of fama, notoriety.
Fame. Yeah, notoriety.
Exactly, but I told him, Elia, I don't need this fame because I'm really much more famous than you.
Unfortunately.
Extraordinary stuff. I did wonder whether Viviani yesterday, because he came in deliberately, it looked like, off the back of that group, another maybe 10 or 15 seconds. It was a kind of the Italian drama of it, making the point, crossing the line completely on his own, making the point that not only am I not up at the front contesting the stage win, but all my teammates have left me, and look at me, poor me.
Oh. Yes, exactly. Italian drama, perfectly said by you, Lionel. You are marvelous as usual. And he was also a little bit upset because he told me that yesterday during the stage he heard a supporter. He was on the road. He said, "Oh, Elia, but what are you doing here? You should be in front of the bunch in order to fight from the victory." So he was also upset for this. But these are also the little story of the Giro. This is one of the reasons for which we love this race.
And he made up for it today. A really good performance today. Third stage win, and the points competition jersey looks like it will be his if he can survive the mountains.
I mean, yes, easy. Well, easy, I don't know, because he has to survive the mountains. He certainly has this possibility. We have to consider that we have a stay now till the end of Rome. We have only almost all mountain stages except the time trial, Trento Rovereto, and the stage of Iseo before the finish in Rome. The stage of Iseo maybe is more good, is better for Sam Bennett. So in my opinion, he's the favourite for the jersey, but he has to fight for it.
He also has to hope that the GC contenders don't get enough points to catch up and possibly, you know, make it difficult for him on those final few days.
Talking about GC contenders, Lionel, big weekend for them. Shall we hear from the direct sportifs of the top three riders? So Pino is in third place, correct, Lionel?
At 104.
In second place is Tom Dumoulin.
At 47.
And in first place is Simon Yates.
Who's leading the race.
So let's hear from Martial Gaillon, who is Thibaut Pinot's direct sportif. Mark Reef, who... Ciro. Turn your phone off. Mark Reef, who is Tom Dumoulin's directeur sportif, and Matt White, who is Simon Yates' directeur sportif.
I think today all of the top riders' teammates had a pretty energy-sapping day, trying to keep their man in the best position for 180 kilometres. Tomorrow's the moment of truth, quite simply. From the Zonkolan on, the real race for the GC is going to start. It's a stage where you need legs, and there's no way around that. But Thibaut has the legs, he has the team, and he's also highly motivated. It's the first real test for us tomorrow.
Can you tell me what you're expecting, anticipating on the Zonkolan stage tomorrow?
Well, I think it will be a battle between the GC guys. Yeah, hopefully that Tom is one of the guys that they can stay with the strongest.
Do you think Simon Yates will be trying to attack, trying to put Tom under pressure?
Yeah, for sure. He's doing that already since the beginning. And it's not only that he wants to put Tom under pressure, but I think also the other GC contenders. Yeah, for sure, he will do everything in his possibilities to make the gap as big as possible. But on the end, we will see what happens.
Can you compare Simon Yates to the likes of Quintana from last year?
Well, I think that it's difficult to compare year to year, but Yates is showing that he's maybe in the shape of his life. He's really strong. He's so far making a gap on every climb that is possible, and he's having a big gap at this moment. He showed every time that he's the strongest. So I hope that it won't be like that tomorrow. Yeah, also mentally he's now more calm than last year, and that is, I think, the biggest change with last year. So he knows already what there's coming, what can happen. He's been in that situation already, and that gives him a lot of rest. And physically, he's just on a really good level.
And lastly, he's not going to do anything surprising. He's going to ride like Tom Dumoulin. He won't panic if Simon Yates attacks. He won't try to match crazy accelerations. He'll just do what Tom Dumoulin can do so well.
Yeah, that's also his strength. So that's what he's going to do tomorrow.
Well, we're looking to take time tomorrow. No surprise. We need more time before the end of the race, and I think it's a pretty good climb for Yatesy, especially in the condition that he's in.
What do you think about Tom Dumoulin and the way he limits his losses so well and gradually pulls himself back into contention? He doesn't panic. He's a hard rider to ruffle. Have you got any ideas of something that might put him under pressure?
We know that he's calm, very calm under pressure. I think tomorrow's is going to turn into man versus man up that climb. There's not too much tactics once you get to the bottom of the Zonkolan. Whether it's for the win or just to distance your rivals, it's going to be who's got the best legs for that incredibly difficult effort. And look, I haven't looked in the last 7 or 8 hours at the weather for tomorrow, but if it is wet tomorrow, tomorrow's a really tricky one in the wet. We're not going super high tomorrow, so the temperatures won't be an issue, just the wet and tricky descents. So.
And what about wheel slipping on the climb as well? Is that a factor?
If it's wet, for sure. Yeah, definitely. But a lot of the guys will just have to stay seated anyway on that climb. But look, they're all minor things that the guys will have to adapt to tomorrow. But we're really looking forward to tomorrow's stage.
Nobody's going to be in a fake position, are they, tomorrow?
100% not. Who knows how things are going to pan out? A breakaway could win tomorrow. Highly unlikely. But for us defending the jersey, going for the win would be a bonus because there's that extra 10 seconds. But now we've got a long way to go. So. Yeah, who knows what happened, but you know, Michael Rogers has won here before in a breakaway, and it definitely could happen. But if it does, it'll be a race within a race, and that'll be one up front and one with the big GC contenders.
Ciro, we heard from the director sportifs of those three riders, Pino, Dumoulin and Yates. How do you see the battle between those three going into this weekend and the Zonkelan?
Well, certainly Yates now is the favourite for the pink jersey, I guess. And normally on the Zonkelan, he should gain time about Dumoulin because he needs more time, and because in time trial on the paper, certainly Dumoulin is stronger than him. But we have also to consider this. So far, this Giro has been very hard. Almost every day, except from today, but almost every day has been very hard. And apart from Pozzovivo, all the main contenders for the GC are quite young. I mean, Yates 19-2, Dumoulin 90, Pinot 90. I mean, so we can't know really well now how they can react to the third week. Certainly Dumoulin more, because he already won last year. But I don't think that this Giro is already ended. I mean, with the victory of Yates, I mean that there are a lot of things to happen still.
Italy got to know Tom Dumoulin last year and I think fell in love with him. He fell in love with the Giro. I think he won Italy over. But what's the impression of Simon Yates in Italy and in the media particularly?
Well, so far is still not really well known. I mean, we are discovering him in this Giro for the first time. Certainly was already white jersey at the Tour last year, already sixth in the Vuelta 2 years ago, but so far was not really well known in Italy. Certainly he doesn't speak Italian. You know that with English, Italians sometimes have problems. I mean, I a clear exception, obviously, but as a matter of fact, I think that for the moment they are appreciate him as a guy, as a rider, but certainly Italian tifosi, I mean, they are waiting for Fabio Aru. I mean, certainly this is the real, because certainly Pozzovivo is better so far.
How do you assess the atmosphere in that UAE team, Ciro? Because I've been speaking to a few of the staff members this week and the director sportifs, and pointed out to them, I'm sure they realise already, that their three big signings, Christophe, Dan Martin and Fabio Aru, have flattered to deceive for various reasons so far this season.
Well, so far their season hasn't been very successful, this is for sure. And this Giro will be really important. I mean, certainly Aru has to fight. I mean, he's not out of the contention. I mean, certainly he's far, but he can, or can still do a lot of things in the Giro, but for sure, if the Giro, I mean, the balance will be negative for Fabio Aru, I think that something could change in the team. I'm not about Aru, because you know Aru signed a 3-year contract, but concerning the people that are working around him, as his coach Paolo Tiralongo, it won't be a surprise if Saroni and the management could change something in the staff around him.
Just very quickly before we say goodbye to Ciro. Ciro, last 2 or 3 days we've had the kind of rumour mill has been hotting up as far as the ciclomercato, the buying and selling of riders ahead of next year. What are the hottest rumours?
The story about what will happen with the Dimension Data team and the Deloitte sponsorship, and the possibility that Deloitte might come to the rescue of BMC. There's a lot going on. We might have a very busy transfer market come the Tour de France.
It's true. The transfer market market is very busy. I mean, there are a lot of things, but there are also a transfer market of journalists, you know. Also, I mean, sometimes this can happen, but I can assure you, dear listeners, I will be with Gazzetta for other 5 years, and I will be with you with this podcast maybe forever.
Extraordinary. Absolutely no information whatsoever there about the transfer rumours. But let's just wrap up on... He's gone. Yeah, Chiro's gone. Run off. The wrap up on the Zonkala and anticipation hotting up for that. Weather forecast not looking brilliant. It could rain. Matt White was suggesting that if it rained, it would make it even more challenging. But looking at the list of winners on the Zonkalan, the race, the Giro first went there in 2003, Gilberto Simoni, but that was on the slightly easier Sutrio side, right?
Yeah, the Sutrio side, well, the last 3 kilometres from that side are incredibly difficult, but the first sort of three quarters of the climb are a lot easier than the side we'll go up tomorrow.
Simoni won again in 2007 from the Ovalo side, which will be used tomorrow. Ivan Basso won there in 2010. Igor Anton, the only former winner on the Zonkalan who's in the race this year, he won in 2011. And Mick Rogers in 2014, and that was from a break. So what Matt White said there about possibly if a break does go and gets a big enough advantage, they could contest a stage win. I should just also mention that the Giro Rosa will be visiting the Zonkalan this July from the Ovaro side for the first time. Fabiana Luperini won from the Sutrio side in the Giro Femminile, as it was called then, 1997 that was. So I mean, it's the Zonkalan, it's a sort of modern classic of the Giro, isn't it? It's in terms of difficulty, where does it fit with, say, something like the Angliru from the Vuelta?
Well, I think it's the equal of the Angliru. There are various different measures of the sort of coefficients and algorithms that can be used to quantify which climb is harder than, or how climbs measure up against each other. Some are slightly slanted, biased towards length, others are slanted towards steepness, but those two come out pretty much on top of the pile as far as professional cycling is concerned. Another thing that's often overlooked about the Zonkalan and that area in general is how beautiful the climbs are and how quiet, and I would still love to see the Giro go to Monte Crostis, which it wanted to go to and was supposed to go to in 2011, and that climb got cancelled at the last minute because there were concerns about safety. But tomorrow there are a couple of other climbs lining before the Zonkalan, the Passo Duron, and I forget, Sella Ravascoleto, I think, is the other one. But the descents will be could be quite gnarly if it's very wet. Just a word on Tom Dumoulin, Lionel. I've been speaking to a few people from somewhere, coaches and direct sportifs over the last week or so, and it's become clear that the incredible extent to which they plan everything here at the Giro and plan everything for Tom Dumoulin. And tomorrow on the Zonkalan, they've got a plan pretty much for Dumoulin's wattage in every kilometre of the Zonkalan. This despite having not been able to recce the Zonkalan. They tried, Arthur van Dongen, the direct sportive, tried earlier in the year, and I think just before Tirreno, and it was snowbound, so they couldn't get up there. However, if you're looking for good omens, they also were foiled in their attempts to recce a lot of climbs last year because of snow, and Tom Dumoulin won the Giro.
Well, we know what we're expecting tomorrow. We're expecting attack versus defence, and I don't mean that in a disrespectful sense to Tom Dumoulin, but he will ride the way he rode last year, limiting losses and choosing his moments to closing gaps gradually. He won't be jumping about if Simon Yates starts jumping about, I wouldn't have thought.
Smallest gear tomorrow, Tom Dumoulin, 34-32. It would be that way around, wouldn't it? It wouldn't be the other way around, no.
It would be that way around, yes, yes. Well, we will see, because there's going to be a lot of riders from the lower reaches of the top 10 and just outside the top 10 looking to move up. And with the stage win up for grabs as well, well, it will be an interesting day.
A San Francisco.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Now, Daniel, there's been some controversy in the Pedaleur de Charme competition this week. I mean, I can see Friends of the Podcast specials being made about this in years to come.
I don't really get involved in Pedal of the Show.
No, standard. Last night I read out the nominations and I've been overruled by the competitions committee, which I can hear stampeding into Venice Airport this evening. So the nominations are now on Twitter. If you go to our Twitter handle, cycling_podcast, you can vote. Sam Bennett is leading the way quite convincingly at the moment. Luis Leon Sanchez, Esteban Chavez and Marco Frapporti need your support. So, I'm saying nothing. I'm saying nothing. But the Pedaleur de Charme prize will be a Rafa Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt. We will hand that out to the winner. You can buy one if you wish on rafa.cc or go to thecyclingpodcast.com/shop. But I think this week's Pedaleur de Charme will be mired in controversy for years, decades to come.
Talking of controversy.
Is that really him?
Well, it's a bloke leaving Michele Ferrari's house on a what looked like a Celeste Bianchi bike.
Wow, steady on. We don't want people to draw any conclusions as to who's visiting Dr. Michele Ferrari.
Right, it definitely wasn't anyone in team kit, was it, Lon?
But do you think that was him?
I'm not sure. I think he's going at a decent old clip there, Lon. He might be in Rovigo by the time we catch up with him.
Oh, what a shame. I'm sure he'd wanted to chat, meet the cycling podcast.
All dressed in black, wasn't he?
Well, that's so frustrating. We might have just seen him. We were, 75 metres away?
Definitely in his house. Can only have been his address.
Do you think he's going to the start?
Not impossible. No answer, Lionel, at the moment.
Well, he's gone off on his bike to the start of the stage.
Maybe we should get back in the car.
Chi?
Buongiorno, c'è Michele?
No.
Ah, ho capito.
Chi è,
scusi? Sono un giornalista, stavo qua per il Giro d'Italia, quindi...
No, mi dispiace, non c'è perché fuori in bicicletta.
Ho capito, va bene.
Amico. Il Giro d'Italia non mi interessa, grazie.
Ho capito, grazie.
Buongiorno.
Well, Daniel, what did she say?
Well, she said, hello, buongiorno. She asked who it was. I didn't reveal that we were from the cycling podcast. I just said, is Michele around? And we suspected it was him, didn't we, leaving the house about, 200 metres ahead of us as we walked up to his house, leaving on his bike. And she indeed confirmed that, said that he was out training. Not just that he was out for a pootle on his bike line. Michele Ferrari was training this morning.
You don't think he's gone to the start?
Well, no. Because the lady we spoke to, I presume might be his wife, said that the Giro d'Italia does not interest them.
Interesting. Well, this is Dr. Michele Ferrari, probably the most notorious doctor that's been involved in cycling, I guess.
Well, certainly in the last 30 years, the famously coached Lance Armstrong, numerous other riders, Ivan Gotti, also a Giro d'Italia winner, Pavel Tonkov, my beloved Pavel Tonkov, and numerous others over the years, of course, is now banned for life subsequent to the USADA reasoned decision, which also effectively took down Lance Armstrong.
Well, his house is, we won't give away the exact location, but it's sort of on the outskirts of Ferrara, isn't it? On a fairly busy-ish single carriageway road. Set back well off the road, there's a gate at the end of the driveway where we rang the bell, and I would say it's fairly typical of the houses around here, kind of a I wouldn't say mansion, but there's certainly sort of large,
low-slung red brick villa. Fairly, wouldn't say opulent, but fairly well-to-do on a nice plot of land. We're in Ferrara, as Lionel says, in the middle of the Pianura Padana, so this huge expanse of very flat land that really stretches from Turin to Ferrara. It looks very pretty this morning, doesn't it, Lionel? The poppies are out. There's a bit of a low sort of haze hanging over the fields. Nice spot.
What strikes me about Dr. Ferrari, I mean, he's one of the most significant figures in the last 30 years of cycling, really. Perhaps not in the immediately recent past, but until the recent decision, he was still involved, wasn't he? I mean, he never really, hung up his coaching manual and his other apparatus. Something about him has always struck me that
But the work he was doing, he needed to remain kind of, you know, anonymous and in very much in the background. But it was almost like he couldn't resist having people know that he was actually behind the great successes of Armstrong and others. It was like, really, he needed to have kept completely low profile, but never seemed able to do so.
Yeah, and it's quite a low profile location. Michele Ferrari spent most of his life in Ferrara. He was born here and still lives here. And Lionel, a lot of the most famous riders of the last 30 years have actually visited him at home, at the home we just saw. I think he had a sort of ergometer set up in his garage, and certainly in police investigations over the last 5 or 6 years, there have been, or going back to the Padova investigation, there were riders' descriptions of how they would be summoned for the first test that they did at Ferrari's house in his garage, and he would sort of pass judgment there and then over whether they were worth training or not.
But correct me if I'm wrong, but was it not, you know, there was almost like he was coaching so many people. There must have been a hierarchy amongst his clients. I mean, Lance Armstrong, I think, being fairly open about the fact that he wanted to be absolutely certain that he was the top dog. He was the A-star client of Dr. Ferrari.
Well, I think it oscillated. There were periods in Michele Ferrari's coaching career when he was looking after, well, I think there was a short period when he had exclusivity over, or Lance Armstrong had exclusivity over Michele Ferrari. And there are others when I think his client list stretched into the dozens. And not just professionals, there were amateurs, as we now know. There were people from other sports, walkers, biathletes.
Interesting. Well, we were so close to possibly introducing ourselves to Dr. Michele Ferrari.
People will think that was a hoax. But it was definitely...
It was absolutely genuine.
It was 100% genuine.
Yeah, I mean, there's no such thing as a hoax on the cycling podcast. I'm convinced that the figure that went off on his bike was...
That's what I mean. Well, it was
I'm convinced... But I'm convinced it was him. He came out of that gate. His wife said he's gone out cycling, gone out training. I mean, absolutely convinced. I was wondering whether he was going to sort of anonymously roll around at the start and perhaps... But Ferrara was too big to... Well, we didn't spot him, did we?
No, and actually I've not heard too many rumours of late, Lionel, that Michele Ferrari is working in the peloton. Usually, well, not a season doesn't really go by without there being some sort of rumour or speculation that such and such a rider is now working with Ferrari, when Ferrari's banned, of course, for life. But it's all gone pretty quiet on that front.
Understandably.
Well, yeah, understandably. and his son, Stefano, was pretty much heading up the organisation or the operation in the latter years of Ferrari's activity, as we found out through police investigations.
Fascinating story, though, and the way that... Dr. Ferrari's work shaped race results for, what, 2 decades? Amazing.
So a question from Stephen Waters, a good question. Like most racing cyclists, I try to maintain a healthy diet during the racing season. The one exception I allow myself is 3 generous scoops of Ben & Jerry's ice cream on a Saturday evening after dinner. My question is, as a majority of my races, which are time trials, take place on a Sunday morning, would I be better to postpone my ice cream fix to the Sunday night, or are the extra calories a good boost for marginal gains the following morning? Well, you're in good company, Stephen, because Greg LeMond used to love his ice cream, ate that in defiance of the French who'd consume vast quantities of cheese but think that ice cream was really bad. But what's the advice there, Rob, on ice cream the night before a race?
Since then, I think Edvald Boasenhagen has taken on the mantle of being the ice cream champion in the peloton. In terms of when to take it, I think you'd actually be better off taking it on a Sunday evening. My thinking behind that is that your metabolic rate is going to be increased for having ridden the time trial. You would have also burnt off some glycogen. So the sugar and the protein that are in the ice cream, some of it will go to repair your muscles in case of the protein, and the sugars will help to refuel the muscle. But overall, you probably still have a slightly negative energy deficit on that day. So that's the space, if you like, where you could take the ice cream and have minimum damage, minimum impact on your body composition.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Independent research shows 10% of sports nutrition products would get a professional rider banned. Trust Science in Sport, the world's highest standard of banned substance testing.
That was Rob Child from Science in Sport answering one of our listeners' questions. Stephen Waters with a questionnaire about, well, I don't know about ice cream, but we went off in search of dessert of sorts, didn't we? Well, not a dessert of sorts. It absolutely was a dessert.
Lionel, where are we?
Well, we're in Treviso, a town I've not been to for 19 years. I came here for the World Road Race Championships in 1999. The time trials were held here. The road races were in Verona, a little bit further away from here. That week, Fabian Cancellara won the junior time trial, and Christian Knees was the bronze medalist, and he's actually riding this Giro for Team Sky.
Well, you said 19 years ago, Lionel. I think I was here 20 years ago, almost to the day. The first time I ever went to watch the Giro d'Italia live as a fan. I was working down the road in Montebelluna, bottling Prosecco. It was a big day for Marco Pantani. He was defending the pink jersey in the 1998 Giro. Actually, no. Have I got this wrong? Was it 99? It was 99. It was a few days before Madonna di Campiglio. So it's not. It's 19 years, the same year as you. We're not here to talk about cycling, are we? What are we here for, Lionel?
We're here for the World Cup. Sort of.
Which World Cup is that?
Well, the Tiramisu World Cup. This whole thing has been a mystery to me since you mentioned that there's some great rivalry in the world of tiramisu.
Which has really become quite inflamed recently in the last few months. Tolmezzo, which is a place we're going to be going to tomorrow. And who knows, we might be tasting some tiramisu there as well. But Treviso, and in particular the restaurant we're standing outside, Alle Beccherie, which kind of means at the butchers, they claim to have invented tiramisu not that long ago. We're only talking 3 or 4 decades ago, but I think we should go inside without further ado, because they're going to close the kitchen pretty soon, and find out what's what.
Can I just say, I normally find tiramisu a little bit underwhelming. It's ubiquitous, isn't it, in Britain, in kind of mid-range Italian-ish restaurants. So I'm interested to see what the authentic tiramisu is like.
Andiamo. Grazie. Thoughts, Lionel?
Well, it's very solid. It's like a brick.
It's on a huge plate.
It is on a huge plate.
Si. Okay, so now we're going to get a tiramisu gone wrong, which is a specialty of the chef here. So this is presumably the traditional, the original and best. We're going to get a tiramisu sbagliato as well.
Right. Well, first impressions, firm, tasty, quite bitter chocolate on the top. Incredibly smooth and creamy though.
A lot of chocolate on the top, isn't it?
Not getting a lot of the booze in there.
You've learned a bit, Lionel, haven't you, about the controversial recent history of tiramisu, and one of the points of contention is whether there should be any alcohol in it or not. And we understand that in this particular version, which claims to be, well, they claim it to be the original, Marsala wine is not used.
And that's because children and the elderly might eat it, apparently.
True story.
Yeah.
Una spuma di mascarpone e un pane al caffè.
Ho capito.
E qui un po' come veniva fatto in principio.
So, Lionel, there's a Prosecco jelly at the bottom, mascarpone, and then on top it's a bread soaked in coffee.
Yes. This is the... It's almost like...
Tiramisu sbagliato.
Yes.
Si chiama.
It's a...
Tiramisu gone wrong.
But deconstructed, really, isn't it?
Deconstructed. Mm.
The tiramisu gone wrong really does live up to the name, Pick Me Up, because it's got a good...
It's gone very right, hasn't it?
It's the tiramisu. A good hit of Prosecco in that Prosecco jelly. Nice.
Very strong coffee flavour.
Mm.
So I think we're going to get some information now, Lionel.
I'm Andrea Corletto, and I work in a restaurant beccheria.
In principio, non si diceva tiramisù, ma si diceva...
So what was the gist of all that, Daniel?
Well, Lionel, fasten your seatbelt. First of all, the name. So originally it wasn't tiramisù, but tiramisu, which in Trevigiano, so the dialect of Treviso, means pick me up. Why pick me up? Well, the signora Campeol, so the lady who used to own this restaurant, formally registered this recipe in 1972 after she started eating a version of what we now know as tiramisu during what was apparently quite a difficult pregnancy. The signora Campeol... His mum gave her a mix of coffee, beaten egg and biscuits as a kind of tonic, a pick-me-up during her pregnancy. She duly had the baby, came back here and started talking to the chef about how to turn this egg, coffee and biscuit concoction with a bit of added mascarpone into a recipe.
Didn't have any alcohol in it, precisely because it was created for women giving birth or about to give birth, and indeed their children. Everyone's got their own recipe now, and you'll find grandmothers who put rum in, or grandmothers, that's what Andrea told me anyway, that put rum in or marsala, but the original recipe has no alcohol at all. On the whole, tiramisu wars with Tolmezzo, he says that it's true that the Hotel Roma in Tolmezzo used that name for a dessert first, but it was a different dish served in a cup and quite different from what the world now thinks of as tiramisu. The first people to get the recipe formally ratified were the Campiol family, and Le Beccheria was the first restaurant in the world to have tiramisu on its menu. Andrea was pretty confident as well that their version tastes better.
Well, that's all very well, but who actually won the Tiramisu World Cup when it was held in Bologna?
And they won. That was it. That's the last word on the matter. Domani andiamo a Tolmezzo. Comunque, il Giro d'Italia va a Tolmezzo. Andiamo nell'albergo.
Well, I was very interested to learn about the origins of tiramisu, and I'm already in Team Treviso, not Team Tolmezzo. I'm prejudging before we've even tasted the opposition. But
well, Martial Gaillant, the Groupama FDJ direct sportif, said earlier in the episode he thinks it's all, you know, the moment of truth comes tomorrow. And I think he might have been talking about the Tiramisu Wars, the Tiramisu World Cup, because the second half of the final, we hope, is going to take place tomorrow. We're going to go to the Hotel Roma in Tolmezzo, which is the other claimant of the title of the inventor of tiramisu. But, you know, there aren't too many fantastic, well, rivalries playing out in the Giro these days, especially not Italian rivalries. Of course, the Giro is famous, synonymous with the Coppi and Bartali rivalry, Saroni-Moser, but Pozzovivo-Aru hasn't really got going, has it?
No, nor is it likely to. Just on the going and tasting the tiramisu, I do think that as we're travelling around, sampling the food and learning about the food is a kind of shorthand and shortcut into a country's culture and psyche. And I think that these kind of the fact that there is a Tiramisu World Cup and that there's a dispute about, well, there's discussion and debate about how the dish was even invented, and there's a rivalry between towns and a competition. It's so Italian, and I think it does hark back to those days of Coppi Bartali and a bit later Saroni Moser, the big rivalries. You're either Treviso or Tolmezzo, and I am currently Treviso, but we shall see.
Well, it tells a lot, doesn't it, about the tribalism of Italians and the way they give their allegiance to you know, one thing or another. As far as the Giro is concerned, maybe one reason why Aru Pozzovivo isn't really taking off is that they're both southerners. Aru is from Sardinia, and Pozzovivo is from the far south Basilicata. However, Lionel, Pozzovivo is coming out on top at the moment, isn't he? And he would be probably my tip for the stage win tomorrow on Monte Zoncolan. Here's Bahrain Merida team boss Brent Copeland, friend of the podcast, avid listener of the podcast. He, I think, arrived on the Giro yesterday. I spoke to him briefly at the finish today in Nervesa della Battaglia about Pozzovivo's Giro so far, and also about who he thought was going to win, not the Tiramisu World Cup, but the Giro d'Italia.
So we've been very happy with the way the Giro has gone. If it finishes in top five, we'd be more than happy, but we're not going to stop fighting until we get the best position. And I think for Domenico, the way he's sitting at the moment, that would be podium place. So to go for the win, you know, we've got to be realistic about it. Like you say, the time trial's coming up on Tuesday. It's not his kind of race. It's where he's probably going to lose time. So he's just got to defend and try save the damage on that, and yeah, we'll work towards making the racing exciting for the last week.
And just extracting yourself from, well, your team situation and looking at it as an objective observer, Yates versus Dumoulin, who's your money on?
The way Dumoulin's riding at the moment and the way he's been going in the last few days, I think he's the one that's going to probably take it, looking at the time trial on Tuesday. You know, the pink jersey and the leader's jersey does amazing things to the mind, so I think Simon's in a perfect place to be able to defend that, and Mitchelton Scott's got a fantastic team to look after it, so I think it's going to be a good race for sure, but on paper I think Dumoulin is the one.
Well, Daniel, the rain that has been threatening for the last
half an hour or so is now beginning to fall just lightly. So I think it's time for us to wrap it up. And let's hope, well, do we want rain on the Zonkalan? I don't think we want it to be too dangerous on the descents, and we don't want it to make life too hard on the climb. We want to see we want to find out who's the best, don't we, basically? And we will do so tomorrow. And we'll be joined tomorrow by Richard Moore. And for the weekend, the three of us will be together.
It'll be beautiful, won't it?
It will.
How are we going to convince the buffalo to pause for an hour for tiramisu in Tolmezzo?
Well, we're going to be in separate cars, so we can do what we like, can't we? We'll be off for tiramisu, and he'll be straight up to the top of the Zonkalan, and we'll meet him there. But until then, Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lionel.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa. Ci gira nella tenevo giardina che la raccolgo con l'acqua e lo vino.